warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time. In the next episodes, we shall be discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guest, I'd like to mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom, so if you do hear a few noises off, you'll know why. So, helping us today in our explorations is Sharon Sultana, Senior Curator at Malta's National Museum of Archaeology in Valletta. Thank you, Sharon, for accepting to come on the program to talk to us today about archaeology in museums. As with the other themes that have been chosen for this series, this, of course, is a very wide subject, shall we say. Very difficult and, I would say, impossible to cover in 30 minutes. However, I feel sure that you can give us some idea of just how important archaeology in museums is to the study and dissemination of knowledge in this field. To give maximum time to the subject at hand, I won't be giving bios of my guests myself, but perhaps in just a few words, Sharon, you could tell us something of the journey that brought you to the NMA.
So, first of all, I would like to thank you for the invite. With regards to my journey to the NMA, so the NMA stands for National Museum of Archaeology. For the listeners who are not familiar with the acronym, I studied archaeology at the University of Malta. And at that time when we used to have, in summer, we used to have work phases. So in summer, you used to work with a government department of your choice. Most students of archaeology would be placed at museums. And I was placed at the National Museum of Archaeology, where we used to do a lot of what we call the donkey work, you know, like cleaning artifacts, cleaning bones, polishing bones, sorting out maps, plans, whatever. But I loved every second of it. And when there was an opportunity, and they used to happen quite often, for staying over and above our normal hours, I used to be the first one saying, I'm volunteering, I'm coming to help with excavations, or I'm coming to do this and I'm coming to do that. Then I graduated in 1995, and as soon as I graduated, the National Museum of Archaeology closed. I had nothing to do with it. It wasn't because I graduated and it closed, no. But there was a project. It was projected that in 3 years there would be a whole refurbishment of the museum. So they had a grant from Getty. It was called the Getty Grant, whereby they had to do a condition assessment of the artifacts which had been on display and choosing new artifacts and preparing for the new display. So, due to the fact that I used to volunteer during my student days, they sort of knew me as not by number, but by name. So when this, opportunity arose, I was called in along with another student and asked whether I would like to, participate in this exercise. It was meant to be a 3-month exercise, because we just had to do the condition assessment, which we did. But because we were efficient and we finished the work on time and there was still work to do and the grant was still ongoing, we actually started the conservation of the artifacts which were being chosen. So with guidance by Professor Joanne Kassar, and, she was basically tutoring us and monitoring us, we carried out the conservation of the artifacts which one can still see on display at the museum nowadays. And that's it. I mean, the 3-month stint remained, lasted for like nearly 4 years. Then I stopped because I had my eldest son. After that, after a year, I wanted to go back to work, but obviously there was no opening at the time with the museums department. So I was working with a private company in accounts. And then there was a call for applications when Heritage Malta was established. So I started off as it wasn't even called assistant curator at the time. It was called something like executive of archaeological collections or something of the sort. And from then on, you know, I mean, that was 2004. From then on, step by step.
Oh, that's fantastic. In fact, we should say that, of course, the National Museum of Archaeology falls under the aegis of Heritage Malta.
Yes.
We should say that. I know from personal experience just how dedicated you are to the NMA. It's a fascinating museum, and perhaps we may have a little chance to talk actually about the building itself, which is very precious. I'm often asked, what's the difference between an antiquarian and an archaeologist? You know, people who are not familiar with the field hear both those expressions. And antiquarians have been investigating archaeological sites and purchasing items for their collections for centuries. And they always were very keen to display their discoveries, their finds or whatever, sometimes out of context, which is always a pity. However, antiquarians were not archaeologists in the sense that we would now understand the word. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about how the early displays differed from those of today. I'm thinking of the early private collections and the Cabinet of Curiosities.
Yes, I agree completely with what you said. Like the difference between antiquarian and, you know, a proper archaeologist. However, one must say that way back, if it hadn't been for these antiquarians, we wouldn't have the basis of our national collections. I mean, the same goes for abroad. People used to have their own private collections in houses, and they used to get visitors just to see these, you know, houses, sometimes with gardens adorned with statues, marble statues, and that's how these collections started, by people buying, even locally. I mean, even in the case of Malta. So you had Giovanni Francesco Abela, who was the Vice Chancellor of the Order of the Knights of St. John, who had his house full of showcases inside, and the gardens, you know, were full of. And he used to get people coming from abroad. I mean, his house was in Marsa, which was a port, you know, so like people were coming in. And his main reasoning behind it was, you know, he wanted to show people how rich Malta was, in terms of artifacts. He even had artifacts brought from abroad, but still, you know, I mean, and that started off sort of the basis of the national collection. Way back, let's keep in mind that there were no laws. So anyone could buy and sell and, you know, I mean, just go dig and keep. So
free for all.
Exactly. So, and then things started to change. So, for example, then he left his house with all the collection to the Jesuits, and then eventually it ended up under the Knights. The same. I mean, the Knights adorned their auberges with all these collections. It was more a mode of self-esteem, sort of more prestige, rather than let's make them public, let the public enjoy. So in my opinion, that is the main difference. Because even when you have the first Gabinetto della Curiosità, I mean, it wasn't the biblioteca. Okay, it was called the public library. But way back, you know, I mean, the public library was just for the elite. The man in the street wouldn't go inside the biblioteca. But then things changed in 1901, 1903. And that's where Temiz Amit comes in the picture. Temiz Amit, even in his annual reports, was very much for making the collections accessible to the public. Even the way, and he used to state it clearly, even in, like I said, in the annual reports, I want to make the collection accessible to students and researchers as well. And that's where things started changing. But even then, the displays were more like showcases full of artifacts, just chock-a-block, you know, just showing how much we have, rather than what story are we going to tell, to inform the public. Things changed slightly in the 60s, but still, I mean, I remember when I was young coming in the museum and seeing showcases full of artifacts and saying, for example, pottery type 2B. I mean, what does that mean exactly? And I was studying archaeology and I found difficulty with that, you know. So nowadays things are changing a lot. And the main focus of a museum is the public. Well, the main focus is the actual artifacts. Obviously, they will always remain the highlight of the museum, but keeping the public in mind. So even the ways of display will limit the number of artifacts according to the stories we want to tell. And we supplement with interpretation panels, limited text, 150 words max. We mustn't forget we need to have both English and Maltese, so that's already, you know, doubling the amount of words. And a lot of visuals. People nowadays, if they want to read a lot, they buy a guidebook. I mean, you can't expect people to just go around the museum and read panel by panel. So it has to be short and as visual as possible. And obviously catering for different types of audiences, children, I mean, different abilities, intellectual abilities. So that's the main thing. Anything over and above that is supplementary. So even if you use digital media, it has to supplement and not replace the artifact. Always keeping in mind that if for some reason, and these things happen with technology, something is not working, you're still going to get the message. Even if, for example, a TV screen is not working for some reason, the visitor is still going to get the message through the interpretation panels and what have you.
What about the actual archaeological objects themselves? I mean, recently I went to an exhibition abroad and they had a QR reader system whereby paintings we were looking at actually. You had the small legend panel or the larger, more didactic ones. And then you had the QR reader. So if you were really interested in that particular painting or that particular artist, you could just use your QR reader, which many people have on their smartphones nowadays. And that was really useful because then you could get other articles and further information. When you've got archaeological objects, nowadays, what do you try and do? Do you create typology collections in one room? How do you express time, for example, in an archaeological museum?
That's always the dilemma we have when planning permanent exhibitions, because being an archaeological museum, it's basically you have to have chronology in it. So it has to be split in a chronological manner. But then you also need themes. It has to be partly thematic. So like I said, first you have to think out of the story, of what information you want to convey to the people, and then you see which artifacts fit into that story, obviously keeping in mind that you have to showcase the highlights. You mentioned the QR code before. Yes, those are things we are still working on. Like I said, I mentioned before, the museum as it is now, the ground floor, had opened in 1998. We very recently refurbished the interpretation panels because they were, you know, like peeling off. And eventually the whole museum will have a whole overhaul. We, however, did that rather than using QR codes. We had done that with the audio guides. So we had the audio guides, and depending on the level of information you want, you can press different buttons. So yes, giving different levels of information for different people works very well. What even surprises us sometimes is you cater for one audience, like for example, children who had done cartoons in the Bronze Age, and you see the adults saying, wow, they're really nice, you know? So you cater for one audience and it's basically acceptable for many, many more than you think.
I always worry when I go into a museum context, especially in archaeological museum, I think we have this tendency to want to have an itinerary, we want to be led somewhere, because that's what museums always did. They more or less told you where to go. Whereas nowadays, there isn't that strict kind of linked rope around the rooms telling you you have to turn to the right and carry on and this sort of thing. So in a way, life was easier for a curator in the past because people expected to go down that itinerary and be happy with that. And nowadays, that's definitely not sort of the idea behind displays. So, and yet, one wants a chronology. So you like the idea, one likes the idea of actually moving sort of in time, forward in time. I think it's quite a natural reaction of people. And I think people find thematic displays a little bit more difficult to cope with if they are not chronologically sequenced.
It depends on their sort of level of knowledge. So what we have, what we tend to do is have separate rooms for each period. That's easier. But then, as we know, for example, even in the Bronze Age, you have different sub-phases. So what we did in the Bronze Age was we tackled the first part of the room as the different sub-phases, but then the latter part of the room with the thematic. So we tackled crafts, we tackled, you know, different types of settlement, food, foreign trade. So in a way, as long as people know in which period they are, it's okay to have a mix, but they need to be, you know, like even if it means a physical room on its own.
One thing that I'm particularly interested in is the narrative of museology itself. And we have a very good example here in Malta of a narrative being retained after a refurbishment, which is, of course, our Dalam. Perhaps you could tell our listeners a little bit about why you kept the original and then
yes.
A new part.
In our Dalam, it had already been decided way back to keep part of the old display. So as soon as you go, as you enter our Dalam, you will see the old showcases with hundreds of animal bones, just, you know, stuck on pieces of cardboard like they used to stick them with the pieces of metal keeping the bones onto the boards. But then you have the new display. But that is, I think it's important. In fact, when we will be refurbishing the National Museum of Archaeology, we are going to have the first section dedicated to old displays and old methods of excavation. You know, I mean, these are things which have progressed with time, but it's very important not to lose what we used to have before, because even nowadays, we think that we're doing, you know, the best we can. But I'm sure that in 50 years' time or in 100 years' time, they will look back and say, you know, like, they knew nothing. You know, this is how we do things now. So it's by no way saying that the people who did, you know, the display before us, I'm pretty sure that each and every one of them did the best they could, you know, with the resources they had and with the knowledge they had at the time.
I must say that I recently took one of my granddaughters to our Dalam, and when she enjoyed the exhibition, the modern exhibition, very much. But when we went into the other room with all the bones, like you're describing, she went, wow. She was clearly very impressed when she saw all these bones. Anyway, time is marching on, and I have a few more questions I want to ask you. There has been quite a bit of discussion in the British press about reserve collections recently, mainly because of the Benin bronzes issue. I'd like to discuss repatriation just a little bit if we have time. But in this case, it was the revelation, I think, by the British Museum that said that when this issue came up, that they had, I think, some hundreds of Benin bronzes, and that only a small number was ever actually on display, and the rest was in the reserve collections. So, unfortunately, reserve collections get rather a bad press often because of these kind of very controversial issues. Perhaps you could talk about the reserve collections and just how important they are in a museum such as yours in the general study of archaeology.
Yes, well, the sort of bad press you mentioned comes with the term itself. It's like the reserve collection, so it's not accessible to the public, as in one cannot buy a ticket and just enter the museum and see the artifacts in that collection. But their importance is as much as the artifacts which are on display. I mean, thankfully, I would like to say thankfully, even though storage can be a bit of a nightmare with regards to space, we have so much, so many artifacts that you definitely cannot put them all on display. First of all, because most of them are repetition. And we're moving away from that notion, you know, that was like very popular in the early 1900s.
By the dozen.
So, Exactly. So you have to choose. It's not easy when you're planning a permanent display to choose which artifacts to put on display and what not to. But the way we're tackling the reserve collection at the National Museum of Archaeology is we are having temporary exhibitions, back-to-back exhibitions, which are free to the public, so they don't even have to pay the museum fee to enter. And we take out small collections from reserve collection, so that in that manner, people can have access to them. I mean, we've just dismantled an exhibition which was showcasing the Halsafrina Hypogeum skulls. So those are normally in the reserve collection, and other artifacts. I mean, we had the Etruscan urns on display. Eventually, when the museum will be refurbished, there will be even pockets in the museum for temporary exhibitions or collections which are not from local excavations. Because, for example, those Etruscan urns, and we have Greek vases, they don't have a local context. So due to the limitation of space that we have in the museum, we give more importance to those artifacts which were excavated locally and have a context. Those were donations. They are important. We even know who donated them, but they're not coming from a local context. But we use those for temporary exhibitions, and also a lot of researchers of the reserve collection, be it artifacts, be it books, be it plans, drawings, glass negatives, old photos. Those are all, you know, like reserve collection and part of the library as well. So,
and academics can come to you, make a request, and then come and access either your library or the reserve collection. Repatriation, a thorny subject. Often, I think, though, that it is oversimplified into the big issue of, say, you know, should the Elgin marbles be returned to Greece, etc. Obviously, we're not going to solve that problem today. But I know that repatriation does not only involve such large artifacts, literally and metaphorically speaking. The reasons can be various. I've mentioned on the radio before the report, because I say report, allegedly there was this banner at the Ta'ali football pitch, which said, Tuna Lura Ishabla, on the occasion of a French Malta football match. Give us back the sword, of course, a reference to the sword which resides at the Louvre. In just a few words, what are your thoughts on repatriation and what's been your contact with it?
Well, in my opinion, it will be very simple for people to understand if they make a distinction between what was stolen, in inverted commas, and what was given as a gift. So in the case of the Lavalette sword, that was given as a gift. So if I give you a gift, I don't expect my son to come and claim it back because, you know, so, so why if people understood that, we'd stop this, you know, repatriation thing. But there are some things. I mean, way back it was, very normal thing to do for example, even curators of museums and directors of museums to send artifacts abroad, either for study or else, as a reference collection. So if a past curator sends a number of shards as a reference collection to another museum, you know, I mean, that is part of the research process. So I wouldn't even dream of calling that, you know, trying to get things back and repatriate them. Then there are other things, like, for example, we had a whole lot. It was practically 19 boxes full of human bones, which were excavated from the Shemshiya tombs. And they were sent to London, practically for them to be studied. They were studied. Somehow they never came back. And they were still there. When we got to know about them, you know, and we identified the location, we got in touch with the curators, they said, by all means, come, pick them up and take them. They're yours. I mean, we don't need them. The report has been done. So sometimes it was just a matter of miscommunication at the time. There were even notebooks which were, you know, sent abroad for people to research on, and they never came back, but eventually we got them back, one of which was a Tamiza meat notebook. That's the, you know, in my opinion, the issue of repatriations.
In the last couple of minutes that we have, literally, I don't think we could sign off without mentioning COVID-19, because it has impacted very much on cultural venues such as yours. what do you feel about it, and what are things which will be perhaps changed, perhaps even permanently within the museum context?
Well, yes. I mean, for some months we had to close doors. You know, I mean, we still used to come to the museum to carry out maintenance work, but a museum without visitors is so, so sad. the first time we opened back the doors and I saw people coming in, I was like crying. It was very emotional. Yes, there will be a few things. We've already changed a few things. Like, for example, for now we had to close the children's room. We have a small room whereby children, you know, can play with toys, and you know, you cannot really just stay sanitizing everything after each child goes in and out. So we had to close it. We've removed the touch screens so that people don't, you know, so these are things that just before we closed, we had installed a few, you know, new touch screens. And now we're thinking, what are we going to do? Because they're saying, listen, if it's not COVID, it will be something else. So try to do without touch screens. So these are things which has taught us a lot. And it has also, we had even done, for example, a few features online to try, you know, to still engage with the public while the museum was closed. But even the people tell you, you know, I mean, they'd rather go to the museum rather than see an online feature. I mean, we did try our best even while we were closed. All the different museums, you know, uploaded a feature and giving information about artifacts and things. But it's not the same thing.
Something that can't be replaced, I suppose. Yes. Well, sorry to say that we're going to have to close this discussion. I could go on forever. It's been very, very interesting. And I'd like to thank you, Sharon Sultana, Senior Curator at the National Museum of Archaeology in Valletta, for being with us today. And I wish you all the best in your future endeavours. Hopefully COVID will eventually pass. So I just like to say that I look forward to welcoming listeners again next week. And this is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.